It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Made of pine. Wait.
I can move.
Oh, look, Father.
Well, it's about time.
I'm a real boy.
Whoopee!
Be one and only Pinocchio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, next to me, but many, many miles away, is my good friend Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And joining us is my very, very good friend, the lampwick to my Pinocchio, Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello. Thank you for having me for this one.
Well, you know, you are our Disney animated guy.
I don't know how animated I am, but okay.
So this is the second Disney movie, or the second Disney animated feature, but it's really right. The third in this series, since we've veered off and did Gulliver's Travels by the Fleischer Studios. So I'll tell you right off the bat, if I didn't look at the list. Yeah, and I looked at it a while ago, so this isn't something that's brand new. But if I didn't look at the list to see the order of release, I was always under the impression that Cinderella was the second release and that this was many years later. And the reason is I saw this on one of its re-releases. I think it was 1968 or something like that. It was re-released, and I was taken to the movies to see it as a kid, you know, unless it was like 1969, 70, somewhere around there. I was probably like somewhere between 6 and 8 years old. And I had thought for many years that it was a new movie when I saw it. Hmm. So for that reason, I always thought this was much later in the catalog.
And it was supposed to be Bambi on the Disney docket. Like,
what's that?
It was supposed to be Bambi on the Disney docket as far as what they were preparing for this, which I didn't know. I was watching a documentary about this and I was surprised to find that one out, that Bambi, they just couldn't figure out, they didn't have it yet, the hook, how to get it together. So they ended up bumping this one ahead of it.
But, well, what I saw on this was it was a little bit of the James Cameron thing where, you know, James Cameron, and we've talked about this before, that he kind of comes up with ideas that they're not capable of doing with the, you know, the state of technology. And then he waits for technology to catch up to him. What I understand on Bambi is they wanted to do some serious upgrades on some of the animation with the animals and all of that, and that they weren't quite up to the level that they wanted to be animation-wise, and they kind of had to wait and put that on hold until they could kind of perfect some of the things they were trying to do. And from what I understand as well, that ties into this because this movie advanced them a lot on a lot of the things that they were trying to do. Am I correct on that, Scott? You're our guy on this.
Well, I mean, that's making sense because I was thinking about this earlier today of the order of the films. Because once you get much past like the sixth sixth Walt Disney full-length animated movies, then the order starts to kind of blur in my head. But the first five, you know, you've got Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Dumbo, and Bambi. And Bambi's the one that I always have to stop and think about for a moment, because to me, animation-wise, Bambi is like, it's like in my head, I want to put Bambi next, because that one, I think, animation-wise, is the closest one to this movie, Pinocchio, which, you know, I was watching something earlier that said that, you know, in the person whoever was speaking, their opinion, like, this is the pinnacle of Disney animation, this film. I think that's incredibly high praise. I'm not sure that I agree with that, but this is a beautiful movie. And I mean, the animation is stunning. I think that there's at least two other movies that could really contend for that title, those being Fantasia and Bambi. It's funny, you know, but that makes sense that they, you know, as Sean said, that they kind of, you know, put Bambi to the back burner to work on other things, and, you know, so that they could refine that, because to my mind, the animation takes a bit of a step down between Fantasia and Bambi. And it's like Bambi is a return to this style of animation that we're, you know, we see here with Pinocchio, if that makes sense. Now, that's not to denigrate Dumbo, because I think Dumbo's a wonderful movie. It's just, it's not quite the same level animation wise. It almost has a, I don't want to say a rushed look to it. It's just, it's not as refined. It's more, that one is more of a cartoon, if you know what I mean. And I don't mean that in a denigrating way, because that, you know, that saying that when Walt was around, that would have drove him crazy. But, you know, it's true. It's more, it looks more like, you know, like what it is, as opposed to this movie. I mean, some of the animation and some of the tricks that they perform in this one, it's very easy at points to forget that you're watching something that somebody had to sit down and draw or paint. I mean, it's incredibly lifelike and so detailed. That was, you know, I watched this again last night. I've seen this movie so many times, but watching it last night, that was the thing that kept striking me over and over again, especially really paying attention to the backgrounds, is just how richly detailed everything is. You know, the backgrounds, I mean, they are painted works of art that could hang in a legitimate museum, and that's incredible. And that's just not something past a certain point in animation's history. That's just not something they continued to do, you know, because, you know, for one, it was costly, but also it was time consuming. So this one, you can tell a lot of love and a lot of work really went into this one. But unfortunately, you know, something else I was looking at, and I'd heard this before, that apparently Pinocchio, you know, for all the work and all the richness of the detail and all that stuff, all the money that was spent on it, didn't perform all that well first time out of the shoot. So I guess
that's what I'm seeing also, that it was a huge disappointment. And part of that was because of World War II starting.
Right.
But they didn't get the European releases that they would have, and that they eventually, it became profitable because they decided they were going to start re-releasing these films. Right. So this came out in 1940, and then they re-released it in 1945. And at that point, it turned a profit.
Right. I had a list. I don't know what I did with it now, but I had a list earlier of the re-releases. of Pinocchio because I was trying to.
It's on the wiki page.
Oh, is it okay? I'll have to tell you now. Trying to think of when I would have first seen this movie because I think I saw it theatrically, like I was taken to it as a small child. I think I don't have that memory the same way I do for some of the other ones that I distinctly recall. But
here we go. I got it for you here. It was released in 1940, then it was re-released in 1945, 1954, 1962, 1971. That must be when I first saw it, so I would have been like eight or nine. 1978, which is probably when you saw it, Scott. 1984 and 1992.
I'm thinking, I don't know, because I mean, 71 seems a little young for me because I would only be 2 or 3 years old, depending on when in 71 it came out. But then 78, I'm thinking I was probably too old, maybe.
Well, I have memories of this. And again, I'm sure I saw it in 71 with that re-release because I had seen it, no question, and I knew it and I was familiar with it. But I believe I saw it again in 1978 in the theater because I think I went with some smaller kids.
Right.
There was like somebody older that was taking the kids and said, oh, do you want to come along and help me with the kids? I don't even remember who it was, but I remember I saw it a second time in a theater then. And even at that point, when I would have been, 15, 16 years old, I still loved it then.
That explains a lot because it's so interesting, my relationship with this film. When I think back to it, I think I do view it from the eyes of a child. I don't think back to the rich, detailed backgrounds, when I watch it, I always feel like I've got to apologize to the film because it's like I hold this when I watch it in the same regard that I do Snow White and how it moved the needle forward. But when I think back to this film, I do think I was born in 71. So, if somehow I was a fly on a wall in 71-4, there's no way I'm remembering any of that. So I'm thinking some of my earliest experiences with this character had to have been in clips, through the Disney Sunday show or something like that, because I was familiar with the character, I'm sure, before I was 6, because I had to have seen it in 78. But it's one of those things that it's funny thinking back to this particular film. Every time I watch it, it feels fresh because I notice the details more.
Right.
And for anybody listening to this, Scott's doing just, as usual, an amazing introduction to the amount of detail into the creation of this. There is on both the digital release and on the DVDs, a documentary called The Story of Pinocchio. It's about an hour long. I urge you to watch it. Because just getting the idea of the quality of the animators who were involved with this film, the people that we were talking about the backgrounds before for this film and the details of the backgrounds, the talent they brought in to make that happen and where they went afterwards, it's staggering the people that were involved in this film and what they went on to do after this movie. This is something that is a work of art. And what was put together here, we're going to go on and talk about all of this, but I watched the documentary again, and I've seen it once before, but it's been years, and I watched the documentary again in preparation for this, and wow, I was blown away by what went into the making of this film.
One thing I would definitely encourage, listeners to do is that, if you're into these Disney films, especially like this one, and you care about the behind the scenes stuff and the documentaries and the making of and the, the commentaries and that sort of thing. Pinocchio is one that I see all the time at like Goodwill or Salvation Army, as people are dumping physical media. I see this one quite often as a DVD for, usually less than, $2 or less. It's well worth picking up just for the bonus features.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I have this on both DVD and Blu-ray, and it looks, I mean, it looks fantastic on Blu-ray. The restoration job they did, it's just beautiful. But I like owning it in multiple formats, because a lot of times with the Disney stuff, they don't always, as they upgrade to new formats, they don't always pour over all the same documentaries and commentaries and things. Sometimes they drop off between versions. So I like holding, you know, owning the older stuff. I may watch the movie itself in whatever the newest format, you know, like Blu-ray or 4K or whatever, but I like having access to old documentaries that may have dropped off as they reproduce them over time. And sometimes you get some really good ones. You know, I had mentioned with Snow White, the one, you know, that I always encourage people to own is the one that's on DVD, because the intros are actually by Roy Disney, which I think is, you know, awesome. You don't get that on the later releases, unfortunately. You know, he got dropped. So
I think I should give a little background on the movie itself. This is based on a book from the 1800s, I believe. I'm trying to get back to get the information. The Adventures of Pinocchio, which came out in 1883, and it was an Italian children's novel. And someone had purchased the rights to it and then brought it to Walt. It wasn't that he was, you know, overcome with this one on his own. Somebody actually brought it to him, but then he loved it immediately and decided that, you know, he wanted to go with this. And then there was a long process, apparently, of them developing the story for, and I guess Disney-fying the story. Because, first of all, the character model looked very different. And if you do a search on the internet, and maybe I'll throw one on the page when this comes out on the Facebook page, but the character looked much different, looked much more puppet-like. And in the initial production of this, they kind of had more of a character model like that, although I haven't seen any of the artwork from that. Maybe you guys have. But eventually somebody came forward and said, no, make it more like a little boy. And then add in the little touches, like at the joints on the legs and the arms, to make him into a puppet. And that made him much more relatable to children viewing this, from what I understand. And they ran with that. But also in that story, Pinocchio was much more mischievous and, right, to some extent, apparently mean-spirited, which he was not in this at all. In this, he has his moments where he's misbehaving, but he isn't a bad boy. He's a naive boy, a boy who gets temptation, a boy who needs Jiminy Cricket to set him on the right path and doesn't always listen to that good advice, or gets distracted or whatever it is. But they made him someone more relatable, and I think that sent the message of this movie to children out much more clearly because of the way they did it.
Jiminy has a horrid ending in it too. Like, there is, he's still
or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's not the end of him in the story, but he reoccurs later in a ghost-like form, but it's definitely not this version of the story. The other interesting thing about that book, and I saw this, it's on the Story of Pinocchio documentary. So you're asking, like, if you could see some of the artwork's actually in it, in the documentary, which is kind of cool.
Is it the artwork from the book, or the artwork from the original stills of production for the movie?
The book.
Okay.
So which is very, it's a very, very different Pinocchio. And they actually make it a point to talk about Walt wanting to make the character more likable, and Jiminy was a factor in that whole choice as well. But one of the things that's interesting about the book, it was not released initially as a book, as we think of a book. The chapters were released in a serialized fashion, which was something that the Disney studio kind of struggled with at first, because the story was crafted to be a serialized story and then collected. So they were talking about how when they crafted certain scenes, they like kind of started in the middle. And it was, I think this film had a lot more production behind it than maybe even Snow White, because of the challenge of trying to put it together on that end. I just thought it was interesting that like this story was released that way in the 1880s, before it became a book.
I definitely agree with that. I think there was definitely a lot of changes from everything I've seen. And I've never read the original book. I have seen some of the artwork from the original book, but just from, you know, reading up on what was changed to make this, again, I think it's to make the movie more Disney-fied.
Definitely, yeah.
And it's funny to say that because as its second full-length animated feature, I don't know if there was a such thing as Disney-fied back then, except I think when Walt put his fingers on things, he had an idea of where they were going to go. And, you know, obviously he didn't do it all himself. He had his team of workers, but he would oversee them and direct them on what to do and how to do it. And clearly he had the vision that oversaw this company and what they were doing. You know, it's interesting to see that this was originally released by RKO Pictures. And then eventually, you know, Disney didn't really have its own release company back then or, you know, to do that. And, you know, eventually, I guess they got Buena Vista Pictures.
Created.
But yeah. At this point, you know, they had to partner up with people. And it's, you know, the business end of this, much like Snow White, is an interesting story because, you know, they, having had the success of Snow White, they invested more in this and they tried to bring it forward another step. But to do that, it cost them a lot more. And then when you factor in World War II starting and the, you know, the box office receipts not being quite what they had hoped for, this was, it wasn't really a failure, but it was a failure based upon what they expected from it. Uh-huh. And then eventually, again, it became profitable eventually.
I've often wondered with this one how hands-on Walt actually was, because unlike, say, Snow White, and I'm trying to think of some of the other pictures, I think Bambi to a certain degree, but some of the other pictures, you know, there's some of the other pictures that there are existing photographs, existing films of Walt, you know, in story sessions. There's a famous piece of film of Walt enacting the witch from, you know, the old hag from Snow White, you know, doing the whole scene of, it's a magic wishing app. It's one of my favorite things with Walt, you know, of him enacting that scene, you know, and holding and presenting the apple to Snow White. I'm struggling to remember anything I've ever seen of Walt, you know, in film, enacting any scenes from this or anything. I mean, it may be out there and I'm just not aware of it, but it does make me wonder, you know, just how directly hands-on or hands-off he may have been, because at this time, he's got so much stuff on his plate. You know, he's still dealing with, you know, the Silly Symphonies. He's dealing with the Mickey shorts. He's dealing with creating a new studio off of the profits of Snow White, you know, basically building the early foundations of what would eventually become, you know, the Walt Disney Company as we think of it today. Fantasia is in the works, and, you know, some of the later films he's working on, Fantasound, you know, all these other things. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on in his life and, you know, pulling his attention here, there, and everywhere. And I wonder if that is some sort of contributing factor to how Pinocchio initially performed, and also for a little bit of the perception of Pinocchio, at least like my perception of Pinocchio. I really love this movie. I enjoy this movie, but it has problems. And one of the biggest things for me is that I don't feel like the story is quite as focused and quite as, I don't know if linear is quite the right word, but, you know, Snow White has a pretty tight story, with the exception, you know, we talked about when we covered Snow White, you know, there's the whole thing with the prince. If you pay attention to the prince's story, that doesn't quite follow, you know, there's a big old gap in his story. But with this one, there's a lot more holes. There's a lot more, like, this just kind of happens and these events are connected, but they're not exactly linear events, if you know what I mean.
I think that might go to what Sean was just saying about, you know, it being a more of a serialized story.
Right.
Literally.
Right. Yeah. And it feels that way too. I think it's telling that, you know, when this was adapted as a comic, you know, it was called The Adventures of Pinocchio, because that kind of is what it is. It's not one story. It's a series of events that happen to this character. That makes sense.
What's interesting in what you're saying, when thinking back to the documentary, I'm used to seeing documentaries of Walt's movies doing exactly what you're saying, where we get to see these moments with Walt. Walt's mentioned throughout the documentary, like the direction for Jiminy Cricket and things like that being something that he spearheaded. But then it's, we handed this off to the animation lead. And right. A lot more conversation with the animation lead as far as what that's happening, where you're right, we don't see him with the storyboard sessions and things that I'm very traditionally used to. We see those things, though, that are vintage Walt, in the sense that we do some life studies for Pinocchio's movements and things like that throughout. So those things are all present, which are very much what we're used to seeing in things like Snow White and later films where Walt was acting things out. But we're seeing them from other avenues in this. So right. I think his fingerprints are there in the sense that we're following that style, but it's not him in the same capacity. He right. drove what he wanted from Pinocchio and stuff like that. Boy, I didn't think about that till you're mentioning that. And boy, that the documentary really does completely back up what you're saying as far as what you do get to see. And that, I think, in of itself is another reason to watch it. And in parallel to watching one from one of the other films to see kind of, I think it's very interesting to see the different creation of this piece. I'm glad you're pointing that out, because that is not something I noticed, but I was just nodding along as you were saying, because I'm like, oh yeah, that's very true.
See, I didn't find the, I guess, chapter format, for lack of a better term, of the movie to be troublesome at all, because again, like you said, it's possibly not linear, and there's events in it that happen almost too quickly. The day he becomes alive, then, you know, tomorrow morning you're getting up and going to school. You right. know, there's stuff that happens so fast that it almost seems like, you know, like there should have been something more to it. But that, just the same, you know, as certainly as a child, that none of that troubled me in the slightest. And even, you know, when I was rewatching it, I felt very, very comfortable with the chapterized versions that we went from, you know, him coming to life to him going to school and getting, you know, sold to Stromboli, to him then going to what is it, Paradise Island or whatever it's called. You know, like each of those right. chapters felt okay to me, and it didn't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Maybe I'm too forgiving. I don't know.
I think, no, I mean, the examples you're using, they all work. I think where I started to think about this is that at some point when I watched this, you know, as a kid or, you know, as a younger man, at some point in one of the viewings where it really struck me is when Jiminy and Pinocchio return to Geppetto's after Pleasure Island. And they don't know where he's gone. He's just not there anymore. There's cobwebs. Geppetto's gone, and he's taken the animals with him. And they're just stymied. They don't. There's no note left for them. They have no idea what's become of him. And I think it's a dove that comes down, you know, sent by the blue fairy that drops off the note saying, "Hey, your father's in a whale." And then they go off on that adventure. At the risk of sounding like a heretic, I've always found that incredibly lazy. It's like, really? That's how you're going to bridge these two scenes, is, you know, he gets a note from the heavens. And that, it's always stood out to me. It's like they had a problem. They had to get from, you know, from A to B, and there was no connective tissue. So it's just, okay, we're just going to get a note from the blue that literally sends us on the next adventure. And it stands out to me every time I watch the film. It's almost like scene missing. You know what I mean? It's like, we need to go from here to there, but we don't have, for whatever reason, I don't know what it is, we don't have time to mess with the next, you know, whatever. Plus the idea And I'm ashamed to say that this actually didn't occur to me until this particular viewing, but it's never explained, why is Geppetto in a whale? It's just never, I mean, you just kind of accept it and they go off on that adventure to rescue him, but it's never explained.
You give me a chance here. You give me a chance here to give a little plug for what we're doing next. Because right. after we're done recording this, we're going to record an episode of Back to the Bins, which is going to be posted the Saturday after this episode gets posted. And in that, they kind of explain how he gets into the whale. Yeah. So if you want to know the answer to that question, I'm not giving it now. You'll have to listen to that
episode. Hold the listeners hostage. I love it.
I think one of the pieces where, so I'm kind of in between both of you in this sense, because I'm actually agreeing with both of you, but what connects us together, and I think it's the only thing that makes it work for me, is that opening sequence with her where she comes down and basically she's willing to fulfill Geppetto's wish, but basically it's under the contingency that Pinocchio becomes this selfless person. Right. And I think that piece continually going through this story and that being the driving thread for Jiminy Cricket and all that, it starts to become the glue that takes those vignettes and connects them all together into a satisfying ending with where we go with Pinocchio.
You're going with the thought that the Blue Fairy is monitoring his progress and that's why she would send the note.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 But I feel like that's something that's established at the beginning. I do love your plug because I think we're going to have a lot to talk about with that. But I feel like that those two, the bookends right there, they aren't just bookends because of Jiminy Cricket. And to a certain extent, they aren't just bookends because of what happens with the bird and the dove and the letter and those type of pieces. I don't think it was terrifically explained in the film. But I felt like, you know, all of those pieces along the way kept that connecting thread of that, whereas they would have felt like these little isolated vignettes more to me if it wasn't for those pieces. It's an interesting film to talk about, especially in comparison to the Snow White that we just did, because this is, it's an example of the artistry of we're telling a very different story here. And it does not, it's not a formula where you can look at Snow White and go, wow, well, they just took the Snow White formula and went and redid it. They didn't do that at all with this.
No, they didn't. And that's one of the things that I struggle with this movie is that, you know, I'm glad that they didn't just remake Snow White. I'm glad that, you know, Walt, you know, through his life and, you know, through his professional career always had the motto of, you know, you can't top pigs with pigs. I love that philosophy. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't him just trying to remake Snow White with, with a boy instead of a girl. But that said, I can't help but feel like Pinocchio suffers somewhat in the shadow of Snow White. Does that follow? That you see what I'm saying there? Because there's still always going to be that inevitable comparison. You know, he comes out of the chute huge with Snow White, and this is the next movie. So I think it's always going to have that comparison. And unfortunately, I think it does suffer a bit as the number two feature.
See, I think that comparison is mandatory in 1940 when there were only really three feature-length animated features out there at all. And right. that, of course, they were going to get compared to each other. But in 2025, I don't know that it suffers for that anymore, because I don't know that you know, we're doing this in sequence and that's creating a comparison in our minds. But I think, you know, when you sit down with a 5-year-old and you say, oh, I'm going to put on Pinocchio for you, they're not saying to themselves, well, I saw Snow White and comparing the two, this is what I come up with. You know, I think, you know, and I'm almost loath to say that, even though I do think that's correct, because I think Walt was very, very sensitive to the thought that this was a children's movie. He didn't want that to be treated that way. He wanted this to be what we've talked about a lot of late, a family movie, something right. that would be entertaining to everyone and not necessarily just for children. I think it succeeded on that level. I can't tell you that's universal because I watched this with my wife for the sake of doing it today. And she said she enjoyed it, but she didn't enjoy it as much as she remembered. And it didn't have the same it didn't capture her imagination the way it did when she was a child, which is what she was hoping for. So while it does for me, it doesn't for everybody, and I'll accept that. But I don't think it necessarily has to be compared to Snow White. I think Snow White stands alone as a great movie. And in my mind, and I don't want to give my rating up, I think this stands alone as a pretty great movie itself. I really do. I think, you know, the flaws you're pointing out are valid, but I don't think they are fatal flaws by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, no. Don't get me wrong. No, I mean, I'm not going to dump on the movie. I mean, I adore this movie. It's just, I have noticed over time that there are things that I think hold it back. Like I say, I kind of wonder if it does suffer a bit from just where Walt was in his life, not being able to give it his full attention the way that I'm at least assuming that he did with Snow White. And I think some of that becomes apparent on multiple rewatches of the film. One of the things, and you just hit on something that, an idea that was kind of formulating in the back of my mind, I think you really expressed it well, is that I think this movie does skew younger. It's not quite, you know, Snow White is a film, you know, people can argue that it's for kids, but I think if you sit down and you start watching that movie, even if you go in as the biggest skeptic in the world and I don't want to watch some dumb cartoon for kids, I think that movie is great enough that by the end of it, you've well gone beyond that hurdle and you've just embraced it as a movie, enjoyed it as a movie. Whereas this one, I'm not so sure it can do that. I think this one basically starts and ends as a cartoon and as a cartoon for a younger audience, family audience, sure. But I don't know that it stands the same way as a film on its own. I mean, do you agree or disagree on that one?
I tend to disagree because I do think it stands as a film. I think it's yes, it's you know, I have to keep going back to your commentary because I hadn't really thought about it very much, but I think you're on the money that it is kind of chapterized. So it's not your traditional film where it's got beginning, middle, end, and it's not, you know, act one, act two, act three. It's definitely formulated differently, but I do think it is an overall story arc, and the overall story arc or the message of the movie is basically telling children to behave. That's the message of the movie,
right?
You know, to use your common sense, to not be tempted, you know, not to let temptation take you where it shouldn't. I mean, that's really the message of this movie. So it is a message for children, but I do think there's enough in there. I think the beautiful animation carries it a lot for adults. I think you just sit there and you could just be in, you know, awestruck over the beauty of the animation, whereas a child might have that go over their head. I think there's a couple of lines that are given periodically throughout when Honest John is talking, or when there's this at the very end when Geppetto's crying, saying, "Oh, you know," he says, "Why are you crying?" "Because you died." He said, no, you're dead. You're dead." I was cracking up laughing. I thought that was great. So there's parts in here that I think are meant for an adult sense of humor. And I think, you know, without being racy or whatever, but, you know, there's comments that are going on that I think are definitely intended to be family friendly. They're, again, not racy, not controversial, but things that a child probably won't see as amusing as an adult would. So that there's things in there that the parents who are taking the child to the movies are going to still get entertained by. And I think that's something that, you know, may have gotten lost over the years a little bit with certain movies. And I think it got picked up again big time when Pixar started doing movies. Right. So, you know, I think as we go through this retrospective, we might see movies where I say, you know, this one is not as carefully crafted, or this one isn't written as strongly, but I think this one is. I honestly do. And I think it shows that they went through the painstaking process of saying, okay, we're going to adapt the book, but now what do we have to change to make this right? We have to change the look of the character. We have to change the general attitude of the character. We have to make him likable where he wasn't. And I think all of that comes through. And I think it really does make for a great movie.
There's some areas where I think it exceeds Snow White. And that's the area where I fall apart sometimes when I haven't watched this one in a while, because I typically tend to view this then as a lesser film. So I walked into this one kind of, I know what my rating's going to be. I know where I'm at on this film. Then I watched it and it put me in a very different place. One of the areas I think it excels is the diverse character development, where instead of having groups of dwarves and Snow White and things like that, we've got really interesting character arcs for, like, even the cat. Figaro has an arc. Cleo has an arc. Jiminy has an arc. Geppetto has an arc. Even some of the bad guys have an arc, you know, in this, where there's some development with them as they continue on with their story. And I felt like the layers of interesting people to follow, and the fact that it isn't just, I think this is where it starts being more than just vignettes. It's when you get to see that these pieces do have these continuing threads of development. It's not just Pinocchio's development that's going on throughout the story that I think works for me. The other piece I want to shout out, and I mean, we're going to get to it further, musically, there are some numbers in this and the way that they're handled that just impact me when I see the film and in the context of, it's an example of where music interacting with the animation, interacting with the story that's being told. These are not just like, wow, this is a great song, let's find a way to put it in this movie. This is right. A song that it belongs in the movie, belongs with the animation, belongs with the story being told, and adds an emotional resonance to you in a way that when you watch it, you can't help but be taken through this film with the music that is being delivered here. And I think that's something where I love everything about Snow White, and I tend to keep it on this high mountaintop, and it deserves to be everywhere that it is. But I think because of this being the second one, I naturally go to dismissing some of that stuff. Then when I watch it, I'm like, oh my God, some of this is just breathtaking in this one. And I tend to forget about that when it comes to Pinocchio. And until I'm watching it, then I'm...
That musical point is very, very important in this. You know, I look back to movies of that era, excuse me, and some of my favorite movies, some of the comedies of that era, and earlier, you know, Marx Brothers movies, Laurel and Hardy movies, Abbott and Costello movies. A lot of times they had musical interludes put into them for the sake of putting a musical interlude in. And they were there, you know, they often felt like they were forced in. Oh, Abbott and Costello happened to be at the club where the Andrews Sisters are playing, and now we're going to see them sing, you know, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B, or Company C, or whatever company the Bugle Boy is from. And those songs may be wonderful, they may not, whatever, but they were definitely shoehorned in. In this one, you know, we've got I've Got No Strings. It fits the story. It's got the moment where it goes in there. When You Wish Upon a Star, man, that became the theme song for Disney for, yep. I think, still to this day. Yep. You know, so this is music that definitely enhanced the movie. And the score itself, and Scott, you know, I always look to you for your opinion on this, but I thought the score was terrific.
It is a really, really good score. And, to me, it reminds me an awful lot of The Wizard of Oz, in the way that, you know, Wizard of Oz, you know, I'm not the biggest expert on old movies. But to my mind, you know, as a kid watching The Wizard of Oz, it's the first movie I can remember, you know, like the oldest movie I could remember, where the music seemed to match what was happening on the screen, as opposed to just being music in the background, just to have music playing. And a lot of old movies were kind of that way, at least to my mind, where it was just, there was just music happening in the background, but it didn't necessarily enhance or track with what you were seeing on the screen. This movie is a wonderful example of the music following what's happening, enhancing what's happening. I really enjoy the soundtrack to this movie. And, you know, while there are, you know, the obvious big songs in this movie, you know, with When You Wish Upon a Star and, you know, I've Got No Strings on Me, the one that really strikes me, both when I watch the movie and when I listen to the soundtrack, is Hey Diddle Dee Dee. Because it's actually, there's two different versions of the song played in the movie. You've got Hey Diddle Dee, An Actor's Life for Me, the first time it comes around. But it's the second one that I like best, where it's Pleasure Isle for Me. Because if you listen, especially if you listen to the soundtrack to this apart from the movie, that one starts very light as like carnival music or you know, like amusement park music. But as the sinister element, the sinister intent behind Pleasure Isle starts to become apparent in the story, that version of that song played on Calliope, played as amusement park, like merry-go-round music, gets very dark and very sinister and very creepy. And I love that. I think that's, it's so well done that you may not consciously recognize it while it's happening, but your brain's picking it up. Your brain is being fed information through the music that we just turned a dark corner. Something sinister is happening. And I love when a score can do that for you. And I'm a sucker anyway for like creepy carnival music. I love, you know, any movie that can take like a merry-go-round or a Calliope and really creep you out with the way that they play the music on it. Because I think that is, you know, one of the most genius elements of this movie, and probably the thing that's always stuck with me the most from this film is the Pleasure Isle sequence. Because this was, you know, a decade and a half before Disneyland came along.
Yeah.
And I think this movie perfectly illustrates how Walt Disney felt about amusement parks at that time. You know, amusement parks and fairgrounds and that sort of thing were creepy, dark, somewhat sketchy, somewhat sinister places. I mean, you look at Ray Bradbury's story that eventually became, you know, Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's all about, I think they were called like the October People or something, you know, these carnival barkers, you know, carnival people that would come every so often and had a whole sinister bent behind them. That's kind of what Pleasure Isle is. It has this surface veneer that appeals to the children, but then once they're in there, it's nothing but sinister intent. I love that. That whole sequence of the film really works for me, and I really like that. And you know, when my oldest boy Scotty was little, this movie used to get really heavy rotation, you know, in our VCR. He absolutely loved Pinocchio. But that was the sequence that he really, really loved. And I can remember him, you know, during the, you know, the Pleasure Isle sequence where things start to happen and the boys start to change and you start to figure out, oh my gosh, what's happening? You know, these kids are turning into donkeys. You know, that's terrifying to a little kid. And I can remember him doing the, you know, the Star Trek thing, you know, hiding behind the couch and peeking out, you know, to see the monster type of, you know, like I used to do when I was a kid watching Star Trek. He was doing that when the kids would turn into donkeys, you know, and it was terrifying in that kind of scared straight kind of way. So, it, you know, it had that message behind it as well. But yeah, you talk about terrifying. And I've always felt really bad for Lampwick, you know, that he turns into a dime. That's it for Lampwick. We never, you know, nobody goes back to free the kids. You know, they're just, you know, Jiminy and Pinocchio escape and that's it. And all those.
Yeah, that was one of the things I noticed in this most recent watching that never occurred to me before. That these kids, you know what? You're jackasses now. Too bad. You're staying jackasses.
Yeah.
They didn't, you know, there was no resolution of that. They didn't go back to rescue them or anything.
Right.
Which if they had done a sequel, that probably would have been the place to go.
Yep.
I have some comments on the voice casting on this that I just think it's phenomenal. The first thought is the voice of Pinocchio went on to create RoboCop.
What? Really?
Dick Jones. Well, he was a kid then. He was called Dicky Jones.
Dicky Jones, yes. You got me on that one, yes. I work for Dick Jones.
I have some comments on some of the other ones, but I think the master casting, the one that really made the difference, was Cliff Edwards as Jiminy Cricket.
Oh, yeah.
I think his voice was the standout in this movie.
Yeah.
But just a couple of other comments on it that, you know, Clarence Nash, who did Figaro, is the voice of Donald Duck, is he not?
Yes, yeah.
The original that's a big one. Mel Blanc was Gideon the Cat, and he recorded lines, and then they decided to make the character mute. So all he does is the hiccups.
And that was his only Disney appearance, too, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If I remember my Disney history properly, I think the only other thing he ever did for Disney was for the Carousel of Progress. He was the voice of the parrot and the voice of Uncle or Cousin Orville in the bathtub. And that, I think that's it. I think that was the whole body of his work for Disney. So yeah, it's funny.
And considering, you know, his history as a voice artist, it's amazing that he did that little for Disney.
Right.
The other voice that, or the other casting that stood out for me is Monstro the Whale is done by Thurles Ravenscroft, who is Tony the Tiger and the song, You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch.
Yep. And the deepest voice in the graveyard in the Haunted Mansion, you know, in the singing bus in the Haunted Mansion. Yeah.
But I, you know, those are the ones that stood out to me to be that they should be mentioned. But I think the entire voice. Oh, there was one other actually. The voice of Geppetto, Christian Rubb, shocks me when I read a little bit on this when I found out that, you know, this is 1940 and he was apparently an outspoken admirer of Adolf Hitler.
Oh, so, Lord.
That shocked me when I read that, assuming that's true.
See, I didn't know. I don't really know anything, you know, with the exception of, you know, Mel Blanc and Thurles Ravenscroft. I don't really know anything about the voice actors, you know, themselves, their lives or anything like that. But just judging purely by the voices that they give in the movie, I mean, Geppetto is my favorite voice in the movie. He's such a sweet old guy, you know. I can totally see why the Blue Fairy just wants to do right by him, because he just seems like, you know, just a sweet old man, you know. And she's just trying to make his life, you know, a little happier by, you know, giving him the son that he pines for. I just think that's wonderful, and he's just got the perfect voice in this.
Yeah, he actually had a different actor initially, and then Walt wasn't happy with it, and they replaced him with this voice. And this voice was perfect for the part, don't get me wrong. It's the off-screen antics that make me wonder, and it's on his Wikipedia page where it says, during the creation of Pinocchio, Rube was, or I think they pronounce it Rube, was notorious amongst the film's animators for his open and frequent expression of admiration for Adolf Hitler.
Yikes.
So assuming that's true, it is on a Wikipedia page. It's not documented, you know, to any extent beyond that. But I have no reason to think that it's a lie.
Right.
So that shocked me when I read that. Are there any other themes in this that you can pick up other than the, hey, you know, you got to behave, or what is it? What is it? Bad boys might as well be nothing but a jackass, was the line that the coachmaster uses. Is there any other theme to this that should be taken out of it?
Well, I don't know about themes that can be taken out, but I struggle with, you know, I've tried to figure out, like, does the narrative work? Like, does Pinocchio
like the whole gist of what's supposed to be happening with him. Does it work? And I'm not sure it entirely does, because while from what I've heard of the original story, you know, apparently in the original story, Pinocchio is quite the little bastard. So I'm really glad that that's not what we got. I'm glad that Walt had the insight to know that that's not going to play well, that we need to soften him up. We need to make him charming and likable. And Pinocchio is extremely, you know, charming and likable. But I also wonder if they went too far, like if the pendulum swung too far the other way, because part of my problem, and again, this is one of those things that's come after multiple viewings, is that the point of the picture, as I see it anyway, and feel free to disagree, like if I'm missing something here, but as I see it, the point of the picture is, you know, once Pinocchio is given life, is that he has to prove himself. And he has to basically be a good boy. Well, I argue that is he not a good boy? Because he seems so pure and completely innocent that I would argue that most everything that's happening to him in this is being done to him, as opposed to like him making a conscious decision to do the wrong thing. For example, you know, his first day of life, you know, after, you know, he's given life by the fairy, he gets up the next day, he's being sent to school. He doesn't make the decision not to go to school. He gets shanghaied by Honest John and Kitty and taken to Stromboli and gets involved in that whole thing. Now, he does lie to the fairy. I'll give you that one. He, you know, but again, you know, he does that in it's such an innocent way that I don't know. It's weird. You know what I mean?
I think you're from Geppetto's perspective, he was always a good boy. And I think Geppetto would make the argument that he was a good boy. So there's no,
right.
You know, right. But actually what she said to him was that he's got to be brave, truthful, and selfless in order to become a
right. Boy.
So the selfless part was really only at the end. I think where some of this all starts to, if you look back at the Jiminy, this is where Jiminy Cricket, I think, is critical.
Right.
So there's touch points throughout this film where Pinocchio goes away from all of those things by ignoring Jiminy. Not directly and not even in a mean way, but he gets pulled off by, you know, people who are influencing him and those type of pieces. And, you know, and even the lying and that type of thing, there's choices that Pinocchio makes. Jiminy's telling him to tell the truth, you know. So right. Every time he chooses not to acknowledge his conscience, he makes choices that veer him from becoming everything that she was saying he just needed to do to become a real boy. Right. And it wasn't until he collapsed multiple times. And I think it's where the vignettes work, because each one of them is an arc that kind of leads to him kind of seeing, you know, maybe the conscience is right about this, but maybe about that one. It isn't until it all comes together at the end when, you know, he has to be there for his papa. And like, he's seeing this life that he could have, that he kind of embraces it and, you know, gives of himself and dies, for lack of a better term.
No, I agree. I think that's the way I interpret it also. There's an interesting paragraph in the Wikipedia page for the movie where it says, author and illustrator Maurice Sendak, and that's the guy who did Where Wild Things Are,
yep,
who saw the film in theaters in 1940, called it superior to Collodi's novel in its depiction of children and growing up. And then it quotes him. The Pinocchio in the film is not unruly, sulking, vicious, devious, albeit still charming, marionette that Collodi created. Neither is he an innately evil, doomed to calamity child of sin. He is rather both lovable and loved. Therein lies Disney's triumph. His Pinocchio is a mischievous, innocent, and very naive little wooden boy. What makes our anxiety over his fate endurable is a reassuring sense that Pinocchio is loved for himself and not for what he should or shouldn't be. Disney has corrected a terrible wrong. Pinocchio, he says, is good. His badness is only a matter of inexperience. and also that Pinocchio's wish to be a real boy remains the film's underlying theme, but becoming a real boy now signifies the wish to grow up, not the wish to be good. So it's an interesting perspective on it, I thought.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Yeah. Because that
I honestly, you know, I think we're ultimately landing in the same place, so I'm not trying to throw darts at you, Scott. But I don't see the flaws as mattering at all. The flaw that you're saying about the chapters and not the through line narrative, that doesn't bother me at all. I thought this was I do think this film could even be it's already great. It could be great plus if you added another 15 minutes into it and you showed what, you know, Geppetto going out and what happened and how he ended up in Monstro's belly. And it could be, you know, there could be a couple of more moments with Honest John. There could be some, definitely could be some stuff in there. You know, there's room for more meat on the bone. But
yeah, that's one thing that stood out to me is there's no, you know, the bad guys don't get a comeuppance in this at all. You know, we pointed out how, you know, the kids are not rescued from Pleasure Island. You know, Lampwick's not rehumanized or anything, but also the bad guys get away with it, which is a little disturbing as well.
But I'm going to say this, though. I think both of those points are actually something I love about this, because I think we come to expect that, like, every movie has to have that. Every movie has to do this. I actually kind of like that this one doesn't. I mean, I think you're everything you're saying is 100% correct, but it's kind of nice. I think certain movies, it's kind of like, okay, this has got to happen. This has got to happen. This has got to happen. This doesn't have that at certain points where, yeah, I want to, I mean, here's the thing. I root for the villains to get that. I actually kind of like that. That wasn't really necessary in this film. It's kind of, it was an interesting choice, but it is something that I've come to expect and certainly something that would have been a staple in stories, even in this era. So it was an interesting choice to try and like do something a little bit unique with this that I was like, I want to seek out. I've never read the original story. Now I kind of want to seek it out and see like, what did they borrow from that to make this happen, especially with the changes they made. But like, is that how that one ends? What does that look like? Cause I just like to see it and how much of that was a Disney choice and how much of it was true to the original material.
There was a plan to do a sequel to this, I think, in the early 1990s, on a direct-to-video release that probably would have been a far, far inferior movie. And I haven't seen what that story was planned to be. But I could easily see a story written where Pinocchio now is a real boy and he's having nightmares or he's upset or whatever. And then, you know, well, what's got you so upset? All these boys that were turned into donkeys and sold and whatever. And then they go on like a rescue mission and somehow, you know, Honest John and Stromboli and the coachman all get their comeuppance.
Pinocchio and Lampwick back in action.
I mean, I could see that. I've never seen anything on Pinocchio 2, so I don't know how far they got along in it, but I can only imagine it probably wouldn't have been very good, because one of the editions of Dumbo that I have on DVD actually has a teaser behind the scenes making of type of thing for Dumbo 2 that they were actively working on, and it looked horrible. So I'm
really would have been horrible if they made it.
Yeah, and
I mean, most of their direct-to-video sequels just couldn't hold a candle to the originals,
right?
You know, I saw the Return of Jafar, and you know it was okay for you know, but those were clearly to me those were not all age movies. Those were for children,
right?
You know, well, I think they didn't have the loving attention that you needed to get to make them all ages.
I think there's a difference between doing, you know, a direct-to-video sequel to like Aladdin or The Little Mermaid, you know, a relatively short time after, you know, their movies came out and they were still big. I think there's a big difference between that –
and doing a sequel to a movie that's, you know, now 50 years old, you know, at the time, you know, because you're in a, you know, society is in a completely different place. So how do you put yourself back to that and be faithful to that? Especially when, especially in, you know, in modern audiences, you know, modern, you know, I think, you know, you have no further to look than when a lot of these movies are now playing on Disney Plus, they start out with a disclaimer. I think if you're going to do that, you don't need to be making a sequel to the movie, because clearly your mindset is different from the mindset of the people that made the movie. So how faithful is your, you know, continuation going to be? So I'm really glad that that never came to fruition.
Yeah. You know, maybe they could have continued the story in some other format, like a comic book.
There you go. And that's what I was going to say anyways, you know, if you ever did want more of some of these stories, you know, a lot of them did have a second life in strips and comic, you know, comic books. So, yeah. Yeah. The only other thing I really had on this is I like how innocent Pinocchio is through most of the movie, but then once the note is given to him, you know, of what's happened to his father, he changes as a character. He suddenly has a resolve, and suddenly, you know, he goes from being, you know, a pretty naive innocent that things are just happening to the hero. You know, he takes charge. He bids Jiminy goodbye and says, I'm going to rescue my father. I like that. I you know, he really steps up as a character, and he does what he set out to do. He both finds and rescues Geppetto to a point that, you know, he loses his life doing that. I like that.
Which is why he becomes a real boy.
Yeah. But I like that whole sequence, really works for me. I like you know, just that scene of him basically telling Jiminy, you know, goodbye. This is what I'm going to do. I love that.
I like that his youthful determination too is like Geppetto. When he meets Geppetto, Geppetto's thrilled to see him, thrilled to be back with the family, all those type of pieces. But Geppetto is very much resigned to the fact that we are not getting out of here.
Right.
And to the point that there's nothing that Pinocchio's saying that is going to convince, like, he thinks Pinocchio's nuts as far as some of those points, but goes along with it because Pinocchio's determination is like, no, we're lighting big fires. And Geppetto's like, we're going to make him mad. It's like, I mean, actually right. References that point, you know, as far as from a very realistic, and Pinocchio's like, no, this is how we get out of here. And we are getting out of here. And right. I just loved how that whole arc played out, that Pinocchio just never gave up from that youthful enthusiasm of this is with his donkey ears and everything like that. It was a great sequence.
I mean, in a movie that is already full of beautiful, beautiful animation, I would say from the point that Pinocchio walks out onto the precipice and drops himself into the water, you know, drops himself into the water, that through the end of the film is some of the greatest animation. I mean, all the underwater stuff. I love the animation of the water when Monstro is chasing them. As a kid, I had one of those, I think they were Fisher Price, you know, one of those crank, you know what I'm talking about? You'd put it up to your eye and you'd crank the movie and watch it. I had Pinocchio. Now, granted, you know, it was not the whole movie. It's like little scenes. But one of the scenes that was in there was Monstro sneezing and basically for a moment turning that little sail that Pinocchio and Geppetto are on into like a surfboard, like it's skipping across the water, you know, being propelled by the sneeze. I can remember watching and rewinding and watching and rewinding, like really studying, because that's a way you could back then, like frame per frame through a movie. and just being, you know, as young as I was, just being absolutely fascinated by, this is animation, but it looks so cool. It looks so fluid, you know, making water work as a drawing. How do you do that? But they did.
Yeah, and that's always amazed me. Even as a young kid, I was impressed with that.
Video game companies today are still struggling. I mean, not struggling with this. I think they're trying to strive for real reactions to environments, air, water, things like that, in relation to what's going on. I think 3D animators are doing the exact same thing that we see them in the films. What they did then with Monstro. Monstro, first of all, is also stunning. We're going to talk about Fantasia and Night in Bald Mound, but like that, these are sequences that are pretty important to me. And Monstro, I'm sitting there like, oh, this kind of gives that a run for its money. Because yeah. Monstro's gore, I mean, it's a gorgeous piece of art. And it Monstro's reaction and the boat's reaction to just motion and being pulled back and what that all looked like. You can't help. I challenge you to watch that sequence and not be captivated by what is happening on screen.
Yep.
Because it pulls you into, this is really happening. Which to your point, Scott, about this is animation. I feel like that's something the best of animation is able to make you go, this is really happening right now.
And right.
That is in that sequence. Wow. In the early days of doing this and this scale. Oh my gosh. It's still it holds up. People are struggling with being able to do the same thing right now with modern tech. What these animators were doing by hand back then. And that showed, we talked to earlier, you were mentioning earlier about Walt acting out certain things. I think it's that Disney style of how do we make sure we're being authentic to reality? And what right. they were doing back then was so cutting edge that you can look at it today. And I think it goes back to when Paul's mentioning like Marx Brothers and stuff like that. I think they were cutting edge back in the day as well. This stuff where you're like just today, you can appreciate it on a different level. That sequence blew my mind.
I guess it's time to rate this unless you have anything else to add.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any mystery in my rating. I love this movie. I think it stands up against Snow White. I personally prefer this to Snow White. I'm not saying it's a better movie than Snow White, but this one, I felt I related more to this as a child. I was excited by it. And despite the fact that my wife felt a little differently about it when we rewatched it, I thought it brought back a lot of those feelings, what rewatching it, you know, some of it's nostalgia, some of it is just being awestruck by the level of the animation, by the score, by the voice actors. I just think this is a tremendous achievement in filmmaking. And I think it's, you know, it's borne out by its place in history as well. It's you know, it's viewed as an all-time classic, and I believe it's on the list of you know, American Film Institute's meaningful movies over the years or whatever. This is Jaws as far as I'm concerned. I think this is just a great movie.
Where this is different than Snow White for me, and it's, I can't help but do the comparisons, because I walked into Snow White knowing that was going to be Jaws for me. And just because of everything that film has always done, this one, I walked in assuming this was going to be a Jaws 2 for me. The movie did not let me feel that way. The movie made that decision. My regurgitating, like my feelings on Monstro and how this viewing, it blew me away again. And reminded me, like, you're an idiot. This movie's amazing. The music, everything that it does. There's certain things this film does that I feel it did better. Did better than Snow White. I do feel that there's certain things Snow White did better in some of the animation, just because of preferences. This film, though, when you've got three people who can have a discussion like this, where whether our ratings are exactly the same or not, as far as we go through this, how we got there is a unique experience. That's art. Because these are no way us saying movie am good conversation and agreeing with everything. we had a very unique journey in this. And I actually loved hearing you two talk about this film more than even my ideas out here. And I think that's a sign of a truly artistic film, because I want to watch it from your lenses now. And I feel this one did that one for me. Like I said, I started out with this being a Jaws 2 before watching it again, because it'd been years since I'd seen it again. Then I watched it and I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. And very different reasons in Snow White. This is not because it's an early Disney film. Of course, they're all Jaws. No, this movie's Jaws for me for very, very different reasons. And that's where I love the fact that they were doing crazy stuff like this back then, where this is not the same movie. And I love that.
This one is one I struggle with, because on a technical level, you know, purely on the animation, basically on the ingredients, you know, the behind the scenes stuff, the animation, the music, the voice acting, that sort of thing. On all those technical levels, it's very much a Jaws. It really comes down to the story for me. And that's where I can't quite give it the Jaws, because it does have a bit of a disconnect for me. I enjoy the movie. I enjoy the characters, but I don't feel quite the same about it as I do with, like, say, Snow White or some of the other films that we'll look at a little bit later. I love Pinocchio's innocence. I love, you know, his hero resolve at the end. I guess it could probably, you know, for Pinocchio himself as a character, I guess it could best be summed up by the fact of that I feel like they tried really, really hard to give you that ending like Snow White had, where, you know, the dwarves were weeping at her casket and audiences wept along with the dwarves. I don't get that with Pinocchio's death in this, unfortunately. I don't know that I ever did. Now, I mean, part of that could easily be dismissed as, well, I know, you know, I've seen the movie 1,000 times, so I know he's not dead. But when I watch Snow White, even knowing that she's going to get kissed by the prince and come back to life, I still get choked up at that sequence by the dwarves' reaction. So I don't get the same thing with this, with Geppetto's reaction. Geppetto, I love as a character. He's actually my takeaway character from this movie. He's the one I identify with the most. He's the one that I love the most as a character. So I really enjoy him. And I like Jiminy as well. It's just somewhere along the line, there's a disconnect in the story. And I think part of that comes from the fact that I don't feel like it's one cohesive story. It's a series of events that happen. And also, I wish I could remember like the exact quote, but I really enjoy Mr. Plinkett's Star Wars reviews that he did years ago, you know, talking about the Star Wars prequel movies. And he was making a point about, I believe it's, yeah, it would have had to have been the Phantom Menace, and the fact that that movie kind of lacks a central character, and that people can argue that it's Anakin. But for one, we don't meet Anakin until, you know, quite a ways into the movie, but also the fact that he's a little kid and he doesn't really know what's happening to him, and he doesn't understand the stakes. So if you have a character to where things are just kind of happening around them, but they don't really understand the weight of those events, and they don't really understand how to react or how to influence them, and they're just kind of living in that moment, then they're not really the hero, and it doesn't really work narratively. I kind of feel that way for about 3/4 of Pinocchio as well, is that he's very innocent to a point of things are happening to him and around him, but he's not really making conscious decisions for a lot of the things that are happening to him. And that bothers me from that aspect, again, of, you know, trying to live up to the mandate that's been set for him by the Blue Fairy. I don't think he's, for the most part, actively working against it. He's just being shanghaied into different situations. And the only time that it really works for me that, okay, now he's doing what he needs to be doing is, again, that moment where he resolves to go rescue his father. Up to that point, it's just things that have been happening to him. You know, whether it's being shanghaied by Honest John twice, or whether it's falling under the influence of Lampwick and just kind of following him around because that was his new friend, and not really understanding that the things that Lampwick was having him go off and do with him were bad things that he shouldn't have been doing. I don't think he really understands that. I think he's found a new friend. I think that's borne out a bit in the comic that we'll look at in the next show as well. So it's those type of things that make me wonder, again, how active was Walt on this? You know, how involved was he with the story on this? And did he see these things? Because I can't help but wonder if he was maybe a little less distracted and a little more involved, some of these things would have been addressed and it would be a little bit tighter narrative, if that makes sense. So all that's to say that I'm going to go a very, very high, a very solid Jaws 2 on this. I love this movie. Don't get me wrong. I'm not dogging the movie at all. It's just, it's not quite Jaws for me, unfortunately. But that said, I do have, you know, the utmost respect for it. And it is a gorgeous movie to watch that I highly encourage people to, you know, if you haven't ever seen it or if you haven't seen it in a long time, go check it out again. Because, I mean, it's hard to beat this on an animation level as far as just the beauty of it.
Scott, why do you hate this movie? Okay, well, that's going to do it for me, Sean, and Lampwick for our review of
be sure. What do I look like, a jackass?
Be sure to come back in 2 weeks, and we'll have another movie for you then. Bye-bye.
Ice cream. Eat all you can. Be a glutton. Stuff yourselves. It's all free, boys. It's all free. Hurry, 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 hurry.
The Rough House. The Rough House. It's the roughest, toughest joint you ever seen. Come in and pick a fight, boys.
Oh, boy, a scrap. Come on, let's go in and poke somebody in the nose.
Why?
Oh, just for the fun of it.
Okay, Lampy.
The back to low, the back to low. Get your cigar, cigarettes, and chewing tobacco. Come in and smoke your heads off. There's nobody here to stop
Pinocchio.
You.
Pinocchio! There's something phony about all this. I've got to get him out of here.
Hurry, 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 hurry. See the model home? It's open for destruction. And it's all yours, boys. It's all yours.
What did I tell you? Ain't this a swell joint?
Yeah, being bad's a lot of fun, ain't it?
Yeah, huh? Get a load of that stained glass window.
All right now, up to it, you blokes. Come on, come on. Shut the doors and lock them tight. Now get below and get them crates ready. Give a bad boy enough rope and he'll soon make a jackass of himself.